Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of Criterion.
Close up.
Hello, Martin. Welcome back.
Hello, it's great to be back.
Today we are going to talk about Hiroshima Mon Amour. Did I say that right, Guillaume?
I thought it was Guillaume.
Guillaume, sorry. Today we're going to do things a little differently. We're going to spend a little more time on the film, just because this one is a little deeper than I think a lot of films will cover. And we're going to shorten the second part, have an abbreviated subtopic this week. And we are back this week with Martin Kessler, who is our first repeat guest. He guest hosted when Mark was out of town, and we covered My Life as a Dog. Welcome back, Martin.
Thanks. It's an honor to be back here talking about such an exciting film.
It is, yeah. And Martin is, what, the executive producer of FlixWise? Is that right?
I'm a co-producer. Someday I'll work my way up to executive producer.
Well, I might have just promoted you. We'll have to talk to Lady P afterward.
Nice. Martin has his own IMDb page, if folks don't know. So that's very cool.
Oh, really? Oh, cool. Yeah. I did not know that. Yeah. All right. Well, we're proud. That's the first as well. First IMDb guest. We'll have to put that in the show notes once I find it. Martin, do you want to talk about FlixWise real quick?
Sure. It's a podcast that covers all the films on the Sight and Sound list, plus maybe some films that should be on the Sight and Sound list. There's a Criterion connection, actually, since a lot of the Criterion films are actually on the Sight and Sound list. So
go figure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Who knew? There's a few titles that Criterion fans are probably familiar with coming up. I know that the 400 Blows episode is going to be a big one. That's going to be really exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully you guys don't come to 400 Blows regarding that film. I don't anticipate it.
Yeah. One suggestion we got was actually from Brian Saar, and thank you, Brian. That was a good idea. And I think we're going to start doing it is when we have a guest, we're going to talk about their Criterion connections, which is a kind of a shout back to Keith. So, Martin, do you want to talk real quick about your Criterion connection, what got you into the label?
Sure. I guess my entry point, like a lot of collectors, I'm sure, is Akira Kurosawa. When I was younger, I saw his movie Dreams, and that left a really big impression on me, and I sort of wanted to dive into his body of work. So I think the first Criterion disc I bought was Seven Samurai. And then just gradually, you know, you look for good films, eventually you run into Criterion. And I'm not really a completionist the way some people are, but... I've been collecting.
We won't hold that against you.
Thank you. But I've been picking them up basically, I guess, most of my life now, actually. I've been buying Criterion films, and there's definitely been points where, you know, I've said, no, I can't go out to dinner. I want to buy F for Fake. So I'm a devotee.
That's a good one. I should also, speaking of Sight and Sound and Criterion, I should give a correction last week. I think I made some sort of dumb comment, the first of many, but probably not the first. And I said that I guess 90% of the Criterion collection was on the Sight and Sound list. It's nowhere near that. Maybe half, I'm guessing. But I was looking at Letterboxd, and I found it's not. So anyway, it's good to have you again, Martin. And I think this one's on the Sight and Sound list, isn't it not?
Oh, I forgot to check. I can't imagine it not being.
This and Marion Bad have to be.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, last week we had Keith on, and we talked about collecting Criterion. And I'll be honest, we were nervous how that episode would go, because that was very personal, and we didn't know if people would frankly care about us talking about how we feel about collecting and that sort of thing. But to our surprise, or maybe not to our surprise, but to our pleasure... actually, people responded extremely well to it, and thank you, Keith, for coming on. We had a great time with you. A ton, again, this is a recurring theme, but we had a ton of positive feedback. We had a lot of shout-outs. We had, some nice blog responses, and we had Rod, who has commented numerous times, and Antoine commented. He's also commented a few times, and then Simon Morley. A lot of people engaged with it. One thing that I think really stuck with people was the idea of organized hoarding, which I think is a good way to summarize our collective nature. Anyway, thank you guys. I didn't respond to the blog post. I usually do, but this all this podcasting has made me a busy man. But I do read and enjoy every single one of them. I think we got another couple of iTunes reviews. Mark, do you want to read one of the latest?
Yeah, nice to see these. And again, appreciate folks taking the time to do this. The latest one was from Chasman Chu, I believe it is, from a few days ago. It says, excellent podcast. This is what I've been looking for, quality coverage of the Criterion Collection. Thanks, Aaron and Mark. You do a stellar job. Hoping you cover the entire collection. Wishing you Godspeed. So reading that, I hope we can cover the whole collection. What do you think, Aaron?
Well, let's see. That's 1,400 movies. So how many weeks in a year? I'm doing a lot of math, and we're not...
52 weeks, 1,400. Well, you know, maybe we'll be 70, plus they're, you know, releasing new episodes, new titles. But
maybe we'll do an episode where we just read all the titles of the collection, and we'll just call it that coverage. So,
perfect. Done.
Anyway,
thanks for that review.
Yeah, thank you. And again, we've said it every episode. Please review on iTunes if you like the cast. That helps us a lot. One thing, Mark has been plugging his letterbox on the last few shows, and I have had an account for maybe the last, probably about 6 months or so, that I never really used. And this week, I got a little wild hair, and I went ahead and upgraded to Pro, and just randomly, and I decided, okay, this thing is pretty cool. I'm going to start using it, and I'm going to start putting my link in the show notes. And mine is DSNT, by the way, and we'll put Martin's and Mark's in there as well. So I uploaded all my, and I really upgraded to Pro so I could import all my IMDb rankings. But I found the one thing I love about that place, and I know you guys are both on there and pretty active, is all the lists. And I found actually Cinema Gadfly, Eric, had put together lists of everything in the Criterion Collection, Blu-ray and DVD. And then he did another one that was Eclipse. And so I went ahead and just ranked everything on the Criterion Collection that I've seen. And I had seen, surprisingly, I figured it would be more, but I had seen 57% of the Criterion Collection. Did you guys see that list? Or?
Yeah, I did check it out. Yeah.
Go ahead. One of you go ahead. Sorry, Mark.
Sorry.
No, I was just responding to what Martin said. Yeah, I did see it and saw how big the list is, but I haven't checked everything. I think my percentage was at like 30%, but I haven't, you know, gone through and, you know, checked everything that I've seen. But you're right. It's a great tool for creating lists. I mean, you can just look up the film and add it, you know, whether you're, you know, if you're thinking about looking forward to 2015, making your year-end list, it's a good way to make that. You could even maybe do like a running list as you're seeing films, and, you know, ones that you like, you could move it around. So good call there.
And Martin, did you see the Criterion list?
Yeah, I haven't really had a chance to go through and rate everything yet, though. I'm sure it would probably be less than 30%.
You didn't spend the hours of rating these films one by one?
No.
I did. I was just looking around, and of course, you know, it'll take maybe months, maybe years to rate every film I've seen. But I noticed, and I'm going to put a bunch of lists in the show notes, but I found the AFI list. I went ahead and rated those, and I hadn't seen maybe 5 or 10 of those. And then I found the Sight and Sound list, but I didn't go through and rate all those. And then I found there was the 100,001 movies to see before you die, which is actually, the list is about 1,200 because they include the ones that have been deleted from the books. And then there was another one, which was the Oxford Encyclopedia of Film, which is pretty much like every major film that's ever been released. So it's pretty daunting, but I think it's a fun service. And speaking of the diary, what I've been doing is when I am about to watch a movie for the podcast or something, is I'll put up an entry. That's probably the wrong way to use it. Is there a wrong way to use it?
No.
So, I've been saying I'm going to watch this for the podcast or for my yearly list. So anyway, it's a good time. Martin, I saw you like a lot of Czech film.
I'm biased, so.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's been a fun diversion. And like I said, I'll put a lot of links in the show notes. So shall we get to some news this week? Are you guys ready?
News ready. Time.
Okay, well, the first one, and this one is courtesy of Criterion Cast. Rome Open City is coming to the iTunes HD or iTunes channel in HD on October 6th. So this, I guess, leads us to believe that maybe the War Trilogy, Roberto Rossellini's trilogy from 45 to 48, I think it was, might be coming out on Blu-ray. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's, I know it's out on, was it the BFI set? So I would, boy, I would think this would probably be a box set that's going to be released this in 2016, would be my guess.
There was an interesting tweet about Paul Thomas Anderson and Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead. Mark, yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I was kind of surprised to see this come from Criterion, but they did tweet about Paul Thomas Anderson, Johnny Greenwood. They have a film that's coming to Mubi. So PTA, as I'll call him, his latest film, Junin, is it's actually coming to the New York Film Festival. And that's on October 8th. And then the day following, it's going to be exclusively available for streaming on Mubi on October 9th. So that'll be interesting. And it seems like it's kind of a, documentary of sorts. Mm-hmm. So it's not like a normal Paul Thomas Anderson film. So really interesting, you know, things there. Like I know Mubi's a streaming service. I don't know if folks have had a chance to check out, but you can stream it on most of the devices out there. I know there's a few that it's not available on, but what they do is they have a service where they put up 30 movies a month. Mm-hmm. So it's one per day. So you always have 30 movies to watch. It's only $5 a month, which is, you know, super cheap. Mm-hmm. And but you know, you want to keep up with it, because when they add a new movie, another one drops off. And of course they do show a lot of foreign and art house films. So yeah, I mean, this seems like a big get for Mubi, kind of like when, you know, Netflix was getting some exclusive programming, and mm-hmm. you know, really should help increase the subscribership. So yeah, kudos to them.
You know, I remember Mubi as one of those early movie social networks that kind of like Letterboxd, and I'm guessing I don't use Mubi at all, so I'm guessing that didn't take off, and that's why they went into the streaming business. Or maybe, I don't know, do you guys use Mubi?
I haven't yet.
It used to have a different name, right? It was
I have no idea.
Something that got changed to Mubi. Like I think it might have been called I forget now. Auteurs or something like that. It was I think they had a different name.
It's nice to say. I mean, there's Fandor that covers a lot of the same material, and of course you've got, you know, Criterion on Hulu and Mubi. I mean, there's a lot of content out there for folks that are looking for, you know, international and art house cinema.
Yeah, but even at $5, $7, $10 a piece, it does add up. I actually had to cancel Fandor just because, you know, I can't afford yet another streaming service.
Right.
But anyway,
it's one of those things. I typically, I mean, I have Netflix all the time, partially for my family, but I kind of flitter in and out, and you know, looking to add Mubi at some point, but probably won't, you know, stick with it. We'll just try it out for a while. So,
yeah, well, it is a big get, and you kind of wonder that since Criterion tweeted, will they get this PTA film in the cast someday, or any PTA film? I've seen rumors of Hard Eight. I've seen rumors of Punch Drunk Love. The thing is, PTA is so popular among young audiences that I kind of think the studios would release anything that Criterion could get their hands on. So we'll see.
Right. Well, I mean, those would make sense. I think Hard Eight might actually even be out of print on DVD, and Punch Drunk Love is still only on DVD. It hasn't been upgraded, so mm-hmm. I think those are the only two that haven't been upgraded. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised.
I think this new film, it's a little bit shorter, right? His newest film's like 55 minutes or something around that, so I could see it maybe being paired with something else.
Good call.
Yeah, anytime Criterion tweets something, we kind of try to parse through it and figure out what that means, and oftentimes it means nothing. In fact, we're going to have another item here that's on that in that same vein. So, right. Okay, moving on. We talked about Rivette and Out One, and I know Mark and I have bought the Arrow box set. Have you bought it, Martin, or are you interested?
I pre-ordered it, and then I canceled it once they changed it to Region B only, just because I thought I could use the flexibility of having something region free or region A. So I switched over and I ordered the Carlotta box set for Out One instead.
Well, there you go. Carlotta announced that they're going to release it here in the States. And they're putting together a pretty impressive box set. I'd say it's not as impressive as the Arrow version, but if I was not Region B, I would be doing the same. I would buy this one and give it a shout. I'll give it a shot. I think I saw there was a pretty good price at Best Buy for it. Is that where you got it, Martin, or?
No, through Amazon.ca.
Oh, okay. Oh, right. And yeah. Martin is in Canada for everybody who doesn't know. So, and then there's also murmurs of a possible flash sale. I looked, and last year it was held on October 9th. So I'm thinking maybe in the next week or two, there's a chance. You guys preparing for this or have any?
I mean, the Canadian dollar is so low right now, it's probably not going to be feasible. Like when the dollar was on par, it made sense to order through the flash sale, even with shipping and with it's import fees, but now it's probably you're not really saving money if you order even during the flash sale in Canada.
Yeah, sometimes I see those Canadian prices in the U.S. and I think, wow, things are so cheap in Canada. But then I see the shipping cost, and that actually pretty much nullifies everything. Shipping is very expensive from here to just north of here. So, what about you, Martin? Or Mark.
I mean, I'll probably, I may pick up something, but I tend to wait for the November sale. But I mean, as folks know, with the Criterion flash sales, you're basically getting it half off MSRP plus with the points that you get with your purchases. That's kind of like another 10% off because, you know, you get a point per dollar that you spend. And then at 500 points, you get a $50 certificate. So just something to keep in mind, you know, when that does come up. So might pick up a couple. We'll see.
Those gift certificates are pretty nice. So I actually canceled my orders of Honeymoon Killers and A Room with a View from Amazon because those come out next week. And just hoping that maybe I can get them in the flash sale, but we'll see. It's possible. My guess is probably a week after next is my guess if it happens. There was also an article on the Criterion Current about The Man Who Fell to Earth. Those who don't know, that one's out of print, and that one cost me a pretty penny. So, I don't know. Do you think there's a chance that might come back in print, Mark? I've heard rumors, too.
I mean, it seems like it's come up in the conversation. I mean, this kind of points to that again, too. Wouldn't be surprised. I don't think it's available in the U. Or I think there might be like a UK release. Some other studio has it, but not in the US. So I wouldn't be surprised.
I can't remember. Was this part of Studio Canal or was this out of print for another reason?
I think so. I'm not sure. Can't picture it.
That's okay. I think it's interesting that this is, again, where we're trying to read the tea leaves. So why would Criterion write an article or put an essay about a film that's out of print?
Right.
And there was also, I think maybe 6 months ago, we saw a screenshot on their Instagram of some covers. So I think that's added fuel to the fire. I kind of wonder if maybe because Nicholas Roeg has a relationship, if maybe it's the auteur is trying to get stuff, kind of like Tati got around that. I think he's about the only one that's gotten around that. And there's rumors that Tales of Hoffman will get around that. So maybe that's...
Right.
There were also three new releases this last week, which is weird that we're getting three and then two. But this past week was Moonrise Kingdom, which we are going to cast next week with David Blakesley, and also Breaker Morant and Mr. Johnson. So did you guys pick those up?
No, that's going to be probably November for me. I haven't been familiar. It's by Australian director Bruce Beresford, I believe it is. So I'm looking forward to checking those out.
Yeah, I haven't seen either one, and I hadn't even heard of them until they were announced as Criterion titles, but I'm curious to check them out, too.
Yeah, there's been some hate on, you know, when you just look at responses, there's been some backlash about them, especially Mr. Johnson. I think people think that's an inferior film, but I actually got those last week, and it looks interesting to me, and I really like post-colonial films. I think those are a good fit for the collection, so...
Yeah.
So I'm pretty excited for them. And then we have the two next week. So we're getting really all five of this month's releases in 2 weeks. That's pretty odd. But
yeah, pretty stocked. It's nice to see, a Merchant Ivory film, A Room with a View, coming back to the collection. So
yeah, and that's another one where you wonder what happened there, you know, because so many things went out of print. Howard's End, I think there are a couple other of the non-Blu-ray ones that also went out of print. So Yeah, I'm actually, I saw that in the 80s and I haven't seen it since, so I'm looking forward to revisiting Daniel Day-Lewis and Friends.
Cool.
So I think that covers it for news. So if you guys are ready, let's go speak some French and Japanese. Well, mostly French. You ready?
French.
Ready for Hiroshima Mon Amour?
Ready.
Ready.
All right, let's move on. Welcome back, guys. What you just heard was the haunting score from Hiroshima Mon Amour, the 1959 first feature film from Alan Rene. This is spine number 196 in the collection. It is a pretty recent Blu-ray upgrade. It's a new 4K scan. It had a few additional extras, which we'll get into. This film was reasonably well received. I'd say extremely well received when it came out. It did get an Oscar nomination in 61 for Best Screenplay. I noticed it didn't get a whole lot of international awards. I saw in the commentary or the supplements that people said that it might have been a little controversial because of the subject matter, and people were worried about it being anti-American.
Sure.
It did play Cannes, did not win. Again, it got a few awards. Marguerite Duras was the one who was nominated for screenplay. It was Alan Rene's first feature. He had done a number of documentary shorts in the 50s, and he's considered one of the important members of the French New Wave, although he's, is he technically a left bank New Wave, guys?
He's a little bit apart from the New Wave. He's sort of, you can see him lumped in there, but I think he's a little bit older, and his films don't feel quite the same as a lot of New Wave filmmakers.
Yeah, I think with the late 50s and early 60s, really anybody making film just kind of got lumped into there. So yeah, I agree. He doesn't really feel like New Wave, but he just, just so happened to make an important film, a couple important films during that period. So this was also Emmanuelle Riva's first feature. She, of course, is now very famous, very acclaimed for Amour. Fitting name that all these years later she just chopped off the Hiroshima Mon. So she has been in a number of starring thing roles. She's in Criterion for Melville's Leon Morin Priest, another out of print title. And then it had Eiji Okada, and that's probably terrible. He's been in a ton of Japanese films. Woman in the Dunes, had a smaller part in The Face of Another. He was in X from Outer Space, and then he was also in one thing I found interesting is he was in a 1953 film called Hiroshima, which looks like it was one of these kind of documentary, or maybe it was narrative, who knows, but it was about the catastrophe that we'd see as the film within the film of Hiroshima Mon Amour. So the plot is basically there's a French lady from Nevers who is over in Hiroshima, and she's into disaster tourism. She goes to the museum, and while she's there, she decides to go a little beyond just the museum in her tourism. She tries the local flavors, you might say, and that would be Eiji Okada. And she, they have a pretty intense love affair, and that leads to, well, that's basically the plot. It's really not a plot-driven film, would you say, guys?
Yeah, not really so much. More memory driven, and I was listening to a list of non-linear films, and this is one that came up as a non-linear film. So yeah, not so much plot, more. And which is kind of the case, I think, for Rene, as you were talking about some of his films, not being so much of a French New Wave film, but thinking of Night and Fog and Last Year in Marienbad. I mean, they're not really plot driven. They're just more thoughts, feelings. I think. Rene kind of working out some of his concerns with what's happened in the past too.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, memory. There's also flashbacks to her childhood. There's a lot of talk about, and we're going to get into the Japanese and French nationalism. But I guess for Rene, it actually seems kind of more linear than a lot of his stuff. Last Year at Marienbad is pretty pretty odd. And then Providence is a big one. A number of his films, Muriel and Je T'aime, I haven't seen either of those, but I understand they're kind of experimental. So either way, it's compared to, say, 400 Blows, it's not very straightforward. Yeah. So, Martin, was this you've seen this before, right?
Yeah, I saw a little piece of it when I was in film school. I think it was the sequence where you see most of the flashbacks, the intercutting with the past, and it was shown just out of context, basically, to see what you could do with editing and sound. And I sort of thought, well, now I've got to see this movie. So I found it shortly after and fell in love with it.
Yeah, that's a great example of editing between the past and the present. There's that great cut from her past to them in the cafe. So, yeah, I think it's a beautifully edited film. And, in fact, we mentioned it wasn't very well acclaimed. I mean, it was acclaimed, but it wasn't very well awarded. But I think a lot of, like, the editing and the acting, of course, the direction and cinematography, I think a lot of those were overlooked. And I think it took a while for this to find its place in film history.
I mean, even today, it feels very sophisticated. You see films trying to do similar things with the editing into memory, like The Master or To the Wonder. And I think even those films might not be quite as successful as this one, actually. It's very powerful, the editing.
Very powerful, yes. So, Mark, you mentioned Night and Fog, and I think that actually segues pretty well. This, of course, is a disaster film. It's about a catastrophe, Hiroshima. I guess it's not comparable to the Holocaust, of course, both disastrous. But they're both tragedy films, and of course, this was Renée's first feature film. It was initially conceived as a documentary short, just like Night and Fog, about Hiroshima, which didn't work out. But yeah, I think they interweave horrifying images with romantic sensuality, intense romantic sensuality, and there's also a little political element. So how do you guys feel that these two films and the tragedy, how do these inform the romance between the two lead characters? Martin?
Well, it's what really defines the relationship. They're both emotionally scarred people in their own way, and I think it's simultaneously what kind of prevents them from fully connecting, and then what maybe lets them connect in a deeper way towards the end of the film. I think to the romantic elements also inform the horrific political elements too. It's not that these characters are paper-thin stand-ins for some historical national concepts, the French woman, the Japanese man, but I think when you're talking about a tragedy of thousands of people dying or millions of people dying, it's hard to wrap your mind around what that really means. But I think by finding a way to make it personal, to make it individual, we can maybe get a little bit of a sense of it. I was kind of reminded of another Criterion film, The Shop on Main Street, which I think, like, the article that was included with it in the booklet was not the 6 million, but the one. And I think that's one thing this movie sort of accomplishes, is giving you a sense of a large-scale tragedy through the personal.
That's a good, and for everybody that doesn't know, that's a Czech film. Actually, it's a Slovak film, and it it sort of processes the Holocaust, and I won't go into that one, but that's a great comparison. So, Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the shot that stays with me with this film is the first shot, and I think it informs the rest of the film. I had a bit of a tough time watching this the first time, and even this time too. I would recommend folks watch this maybe on a Sunday afternoon rather than, you know, like a Thursday night at 11 o'clock. But what I thought of with the opening shot is, you know, their relationship may be short. Well, we know it's short. It takes place over 24 hours. And I think of that opening shot where it could be their relationship turning to dust. Mm-hmm. It could even be the embrace of others during the fallout after the, you know, the dropping of the bomb. So, I mean, to me, that really stuck with me as far as the opening of the film. So I think really in that shot alone, it brings forward the horrific elements and you know, into the romantic element, because then it cuts to a shot of who we believe are him and her, as they are referred to in a kind of a romantic embrace.
Yeah, and that first shot that you mentioned, that's still of them in that embrace, and it's sort of glistening a little bit. It's almost a dissolve with some sort of, I don't know if it's supposed to be debris or powder or...
I mean, it starts with kind of debris, and to me it looks like, you know, kind of, it could be the dust of bodies, of buildings, you know, whatever it is, and then later it kind of glistens to be, you know, kind of shimmering, and then it turns to just the two of them in their embrace, and then eventually we do see them later in the film after the first, you know, quarter or so, 20 minutes or so, which is kind of more documentarian feel. So you know, it does inform Night and Fog quite a bit. I mean, I couldn't help but think of Night and Fog with that early piece during the film, where I know Renee was originally, they had come to Renee because he had done Night and Fog 10 years after the liberation of the camps, and they had come to him to kind of document Hiroshima, and he had considered it but decided that he wanted to do something different. He didn't want to just do, you know, Night and Fog again in Hiroshima, and thought it would be difficult. So I thought it was pretty great.
Yeah, you know, I think he juxtaposes a lot of images, a lot of horrific images, with the love. Of course, beyond the embrace, we see them at the march, the protest, and there's some great shots. There's one shot in particular that really stuck with me, and that was they were together as a couple, and there was a burned body. Of course, it wasn't it was a reenactment, and so that sort of put their relationship in Hiroshima in context. And Martin, actually, it was interesting that you made the comment that you didn't think that the individuals represented their nationalities. Actually, I thought they did, and I thought they did that pretty well. And I thought that the historical and the tragedy did inform, because they perceived this tragedy and processed this tragedy different as French and as Japanese. So I think we'll probably circle back to that later. But since you mentioned the sensual embrace, those first few minutes of the film really are striking, very stylized. As we mentioned, it starts with glistening. Eventually, it does lead to sweat. It's not graphic per se. It's more, it is sensual. You see a hand on the back. You see very, very tight images. You can tell they're nude, but it's not graphic, or at least not by our standards, maybe by 1959 standards. So, yeah, it's very stylized photography. Actually, for Renee's first feature, pretty accomplished photography or direction. But how do you think this sort of photography informed the relationship in this duality?
Yeah, I mean, I it's funny. I was thinking back to what I know you tweeted this out some, Aaron, and Tim from the First Time Watchers podcast had responded how there's none of the B word in this film. And that's a theme with Renee, is he doesn't, you know, show outright nudity. He doesn't kind of turn the camera on it specifically, but you will see shots of, like, there's a point where they're back at his home and she's unbuttoning her blouse, and then shortly after we see them embracing nude, but, you know, just headshots. So it's not just outright nudity, but I think, you know, the film is sensual in what it does and doesn't show, maybe even more so than if it were specifically trying to be titillating. You know, we've got the first and second scenes are very sensual. Maybe the first scene, as I was saying, being possibly a bit horrific. And then, you know, you mentioned that match cut, which is possibly the best edit in the film, of the embrace of the mother and daughter matched with him and her. Later in the film. So I actually thought I don't know if you want to say it's organic, but it almost is, to me, almost images of, like, snakes or other creatures in the way that it's shot. You know, some of those scenes where they're really kind of clenching together, and, you know, you know it's bodies, but it looks like it could be something else. So I thought that was really impressive use of photography.
Yeah, I think it was beautiful. And actually, speaking of the naughty bits, and Martin mentioned Nicholas Rogue earlier, and I did think about Don't Look Now, Don't Look Now.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a scene where they do show everything. They do not cut when she unbuttons her blouse. They have a lot of cuts in that love scene, as they call it. But you're right, Renee does stop short and leaves a lot to the imagination. And I think that is part of his style. And also, I think he's showing he doesn't have to be graphic to... And there's no doubt that they're incredibly passionate about each other. I'd say more so than even the Don't Look Now... I always mix up Don't Look Now and Don't Look Back.
Don't Look Now.
So what do you think, Martin?
I think it almost makes me think that it's in the tradition of impressionist filmmaking, right? The way the love scenes are shot. Mm. I've had to direct two sex scenes before, and both times I've sort of gone back to Hiroshima Mon Amour.
Because
it reminds me that it's possible to communicate ideas and feelings that go beyond the physical act. Like, this might sound a bit morbid, but it made me think of when you see the bodies intertwined, the way you see the people who died at Pompeii under Mount Vesuvius, mm-hmm. who are encased in ash, maybe especially with that opening image.
Definitely.
And that there's sort of a weird intimacy in these two people fused together under ash, holding each other in a disaster, that I think it's it's not sensual in the way that you'd expect, but it has sort of gets a reaction out of me. I find it really interesting. Yeah,
it's one of the most evocative opening scenes that I think I've ever seen. I mean, if I had a top five listed, that would probably make it, because you could interpret it in so many different ways, and it just informs what this movie is about. I could probably go on and on about it, but
yeah. Well, I think we have given a little bit of attention, but I think that first few minutes that establishes the romance, and you don't know the characters yet. And by the way, the moment when Martin said he directed two sex scenes is probably when the majority of our listeners just went to his IMDb page.
Right. How do I get this?
I mean, just to add an asterisk, like, neither one's what I think most people would expect when they hear sex scenes. So
I think you did convey that.
That's your warning.
It's again not the Julie Christie Donald Sutherland variety.
Martin, don't tell him that. They're gonna go watch it.
I know. You just slashed your sales there. So yeah, and of course Hiroshima is a major part. So and they both have different ways of processing and dealing with the actual tragedy. Sorry, we go from a high note to a down note, but that's the nature of this film.
Yeah, it is.
It's not exactly a uplifting film, but it is a moving film. So they both react to Hiroshima, the history of Hiroshima, differently. So what do you think the way they react says about their characters? What do you think, Mark?
Well, I think they both have a very different experience of the horrors, for both the protagonist, he and her. I mean, they were both directly affected by the war, but in different ways. I think you had alluded to it, before, Aaron, how we sympathize with him right away, because mm-hmm. We understand that, he had family that was there at Hiroshima, and we have... even though he was called away, he was fighting in the war, so we didn't hear him, or we didn't see him, or he wasn't there, he wasn't affected. But we learn more about her and sympathize more with her later in the film. Mm-hmm. So we kind of learn her backstory. And we know that this is a adulterous relationship, so we're kind of put on edge, I think, a little bit, depending on where we're coming from, but we tend to... learn more about and kind of sympathize with them more as it goes along. So we see more of a reaction of her to the bombings during the demonstration scene, mm-hmm. During the march. And so I think that's where maybe it makes the event more immediate to her and stirs emotions in her regarding the war and her German lover.
Actually, that's a good point, Mark. That you mentioned that he was called away to the war, and she, and of course his family died in the bombing, and then she says, "Wow, you're lucky." And of course, he's lucky that he wasn't in the bombing, but is he lucky that that he lost his entire family? That was
that's a great
pretty
point.
Shocking piece of dialogue, and that I think that that line right there speaks to their different perceptions. You know, she just thinks, you know, in one wave, lots of people died. You weren't one of them. But of course, you know, and she later, as you said, would experience the horror or witness the horror, even if it wasn't the actual horror, you know, a simulation. She finally would actually, and I think there she was sort of tantalized by it. And I mentioned disaster tourism before. You kind of wonder if part of this is her curiosity of a kind of morbid curiosity of this devastating tragedy. And that's how she's sort of, her tourism is through him and through his experiences. But then there's a later scene where they exchange dialogue about how they, and I think this was in the cafe, about how they reacted to the events at their own country. And of course, his reaction is tragedy. Hers was, right. Well, the war was over. And I think this is one of those historical events that it was responded to differently depending on where you were in the world. You know, of course, USA, we were like France. We thought that was the end of the war.
Right.
Finally.
Yeah, there's a quote that he says where he said, the whole world rejoiced and you rejoiced with it. So he's, you know, kind of, you know, almost not implicating, but, you know, that kind of informs what you were talking about.
I think he's maybe not implicating, but saying, hey, you don't really understand.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Martin?
Whew, it's a lot to chew on. Well, I think with her, she's definitely an outsider to it. She can only experience it secondhand through movies and museums and things like that. But I sort of think that the reason why she's drawn to it is because, like they say, it's a film also about the horror of forgetting, and she doesn't want to forget the romance she had with the German soldier and the horror that kind of comes along with that. So I think part of her being in Hiroshima is her trying to keep that alive, or to relive it to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I think she is a little bit removed from the tragedy as she was in the World War II at her own home. You know, most people were not having affairs with German officers. Most French people were not. Of course, it did happen. In the special features, I was actually surprised. I didn't know this, but Arletty from Children of Paradise, she had an affair with a German officer and had her head shaved like our character here. Well, let's talk about the language a little bit. I'm not a native French speaker, but I took some in school, and I'm a bad French speaker, and I'm not going to talk about it here, or not going to speak French here. Of course, Martin speaks very good French because he's in Canada. But
no.
Well, you haven't.
Je ne parle pas français.
You have me fooled from your tweets. So I'm going to play a clip here, and this clip is in French. So this is a tough movie to pull clips for, but this one I think you'll be able to grasp even if you don't speak the language. But basically in this clip, what is happening is they're walking through a hallway, and he's asking her about whether she's from the town of Nevers. Again, Guillaume is going to crucify me for that one. So he asks, are you going to go to Paris after this, are you going to go back to Paris? And she goes, yes. And he says, why not Nevers? And she says, oh, I'll never go to Nevers. And so the wordplay with jamais is the French word for never. And then Nevers is the town. And of course, as a Japanese person probably knows the word, you know, they were occupied by Americans. He probably does know the word Nevers, or never, the English word never, and he gets a little hung up on that. And then she says, Jeune à Nevers is, she was young in Nevers, and then later she says, Folle à Nevers, and she was crazy in Nevers. So anyway, I'm going to play that clip right now.
Où vas-tu en France? À Nevers?
Non, à Paris. À Nevers, non, je ne vais plus jamais.
Jamais?
Jamais. C'est à Nevers que j'étais le plus jeune de toute ma vie.
Jeune à Nevers.
Oui. Jeune à Nevers. Et puis aussi une fois, folle à Nevers.
Okay, so yeah, they use language, and it's very elementary French. I don't know if you guys picked up on this. I picked up that I understood a lot, which speaks to the French. But the male protagonist, who I guess we can call him Hiroshima, he gets hung up on the words like there. He gets hung up on Jun. So do you think the use of language adds to this film much? What do you think, Martin?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's almost on the character's part an unintentional poetry to it, as you sort of realize things have double or maybe even endless meanings. Like, I really like the moment when he asks if Nevers has any other meaning in French. Mm-hmm. And to her it has another meaning, and to us it has other meanings. You sort of realize that I think in some ways it almost shows the limitation of language. Like, they can describe what happened in a very straightforward way, very plainly, but the emotion, it's like this bottomless pit hanging under every word.
Yeah, and it's also kind of another layer of separation between the two. And in fact, in the word never and Nevers, he comprehends English. She probably doesn't. Don't gather she speaks English. She probably isn't aware of that connection, or at least does not acknowledge it. So I think.
And it's interesting too how the tenses change. Sometimes the past becomes the present, and you sort of get the sense that the memory is happening again in a sort of literal way. Like, I think sometimes she's speaking to him as if he's the German lover, and sometimes she's talking as if the past is still happening.
And yeah,
that's sort of what the film does. Yeah,
and also it's formal. It's not conversational. Well, it's conversational French because it's basic, but they don't use the two. They use the vous, I believe, if I recall correctly. Is that right?
I think you're right.
What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I was thinking about the language, and just made a few notes. I think as far as how they use it, I mean, as you said, it was kind of an elementary use of language because they do need to be able to communicate. And he comes across as having knowing French, but as we from the special features we find out, he actually a lot of that was post dubbed later because he didn't know French. And I don't know how much that really informs the screenplay itself, but what I kind of took from it is, he focuses a lot on her in his language. He says things like, "You give me a tremendous desire to love," and he said, he uses you quite a bit, and she uses I quite a bit. Like, I thought of so she's really focusing on herself and kind of where she is at, and some of the memories with the German soldier that this brings back, and how she's working through, being in Hiroshima, and her marriage and her lover here. And she says, this city fits me like a glove. I was hungry for infidelity, for adultery, for lies, and for death. There's death. I always have been. So it's interesting to me how they kind of, he's always looking and focusing on her, and she's often turning inwardly, and we see much more of her inner thoughts. And it's really the flashbacks are mainly from her and some of her past experiences.
Yeah, she's a very dark person, if you really... and I think had a very dark history, dark past. So, and of course, this is all in the backdrop in 1959, or I guess it was probably taped in 58, but this is in the post-World War II, and Hiroshima signifies the atomic age, or the nuclear age, and that's still, in that point, that's still a threat. And I think through each other, they also process their fears and fascinations, actually, with the atomic age, and the fact that in a blink, just because some politician doesn't like some other politician in another country, the whole world could get blown to bits. So, would you guys say they're afraid of the atomic age, or do you think they're allured by it, or do you think it's different? What do you think, Martin?
I think that they're burdened by its inevitability. I think the way you see repetition in the heartbreak of the relationships, I think the film presumes an inevitable repetition of the larger scale horror. I think the intangibility of the past makes the future dim in this film.
And immediate too. That's why they're so forced in love with each other, and so energetically in love with each other, because they do believe that their last days are coming. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I think they're both. The easy answer would be that they're both afraid and allured to it. But I think the opening part of it speaks directly to this and how it can be interpreted. I mean, I know I keep coming back to the opening, but you see them and they're it's almost could be considered their crumbling time together. As I had said, I saw it as it could be two people embracing for the last time after the bombing, or maybe they are survivors. So I think that shot again informs how they are. I think they're more afraid of the atomic age. I mean, they've seen it, the bomb drop once, and there is that within the parade, they're kind of speaking to that more about, stop nuclear testing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, really Alain René kind of informing, maybe outside of the characters, his view, his kind of more leftist view,
for
again,
sure.
with Duras about, the coming, potentially atomic age.
Yeah, and, when she's, after the embracing, the romantic scenes, when she goes to the museum, I don't know if you guys have been to New York to the 9/11 museum, but actually I would not compare the two events. I mean, they're both tragedies, but of course, well, I guess you could compare, not in lives lost, there are of course many more lost in Hiroshima, but they're both, tragedies for our respective nations. But
right.
When I saw the little... what was on display, it did remind me of the same kind of stuff that was on display in the 9/11 museum. And of course we went there, and we are, I guess, and we lost somebody in 9/11, sorry to bring a cast down even further. So I wouldn't say I'm allured to it. It's part tragedy and part, again, processing. So that experience was very different for me going to that museum than it was for her. Hers was more tourism, and I'd say in that respect she was allured to it by it, and she was fascinated by the vast devastation that she that she saw. And it was only until later, when she sees the demonstration, that she kind of wises up. But I think she's always and I think that's part of her fascination with him, in that he represents this tragedy. And he wasn't there physically. He wasn't in the country, but he was there. He lived during the period. So, anyway, Martin mentioned the German character quite a bit, and I think that also has a lot of significance. So then she's fascinated by Hiroshima, but he's fascinated by her German lover. So why do you think that is, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, he's often focusing on her, as I was saying before, and he wants to know, really how that early experience informed her, and she's really bringing that to the forefront. It informs so much of what happens, I think, with the some of the flashbacks and how he's how she is dealing with the relationship with him. I think some of what you see in the film too is covered in other aspects, like the haircutting of mm-hmm. her because of her affair with a German soldier. I saw that. I think it's been in other movies. I remember it specifically from the Band of Brothers HBO series. I know that was covered there. I even thought of, I don't know if you guys kind of pictured this, but I thought of Falconetti in The Passion of Joan of Arc, although her hair is
definitely, absolutely.
Her hair is a little bit longer, but it kind of informed that film for me too.
Actually, going back to what you were saying about how he related to her past, he actually was pleased and actually thrilled by the fact that he was received this privileged information. So, and I think that actually was his fulfillment, whereas hers was immersing herself in this tragedy through the museum and of course the romantic elements. So, what do you think, Martin?
Definitely. Like, I think she mentions that she never told it to her husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's also sort of implied that she has had other lovers. But it really does seem like she's only told this to him. So I think it's pleasing to him because he feels like their relationship has a meaning beyond... him just being another, string of lovers, that it's not just disposable.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
He's in a way more important than her husband. And I think they express that to each other. So, on that note, do you think this is, would you call this little tryst real love, or would you call this tourism?
I think it starts off as tourism. I think it's interesting too, that the character she is an actress, and she's sort of, mm-hmm. playing a certain role in this romance. Yeah, she wouldn't, they wouldn't leave their spouses for one another. And I think, like, I can't really imagine them together after the end of the film, but I think by the end, it's perhaps grown into something deeper. They share a look near the end, which to me says that they share a common pain, and that I think it's very powerful. I'm using that word a lot to describe that film. Sorry.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's tough. I thought of it as tourism, and I kept coming back to that. And the more I'm removed from the film, I think I'm more sympathetic to both characters, especially to her. But I just had a tough time for them originally. I mean, as I said before, he's always looking at her, and I think that, you know, almost more of a curiosity, it seems. And you know, they're only spending 24 hours together, but we don't, as I said, we don't really get to know him. And she was always looking for infidelity, from what we can tell. I mean, she comes out and says that, but she always is. So, you know, she only seems kind of mildly interested, I think, especially maybe later on, like he was more of a curiosity. Especially, I think of that scene in the nightclub. I won't mention the name because that's going to come up later. How, you know, he's just sitting there, and she's just kind of looking at him while another Japanese man is you know, started talking to her. Maybe their relationship, you know, originally started. So I think really, I really feel like, I don't think this really is love. I do think it is kind of tourism on both of their parts.
Yeah, and of course, now that we're pretty deep into the cast, we probably should say that you shouldn't listen to this if you haven't seen the movie. We've kind of been in and out of spoiler territory, but I'm going to firmly go in spoiler territory and go to the end of the film when they embrace. Okay. They mention, you know, he calls her Never, and she calls him Hiroshima. So I think that that boils down to, they do see each other not as individuals or as love partners. Do they know that each other's names? I would imagine they do. We don't, but regardless, they see themselves as the nationality. She is Never, or maybe the English word never, what can never be had. Whereas he is Hiroshima. He is part of her tourism. So even though I think that the passion is genuine, you can just see in the body language, they are fond of this experience. It's a monumental romantic achievement for them both, but I think it is fleeting in a way, and I think that they will remember it as tourism. This is how I experienced France or Nevers, and this is how I experienced the tragedy of Hiroshima through this man.
Do you think the film sees these characters as characters with real depth, with real lives beyond what they represent, or do you think they are purely just sort of a metonym for these national ideas,
caricatures, sort of? We've kind of been dabbling in that a little bit, but I don't know. What do you think, Mark?
I do think they are seen as characters. You know, I mean, you could. That's why at the end where they call each other by the city names was a little bit odd for me. I can kind of see where that comes back, but I do think it shows how, I mean, I talked about their professions, how they have family lives. I think we see somewhat of what's important to each of them. So to me, I thought they were, especially with the difficulty of the flashbacks, they were fleshed out characters. I feel like we did get to know them quite a bit.
They seem almost like perfect archetypes, and I think by the end you sort of see that there's maybe more to them than just what they represent.
They're human, for sure.
Especially her. We learn so much more about her than we do him because we don't have any flashbacks of him. I guess the flashbacks of him are the Hiroshima reenactments. He's inseparable from the tragedy, whereas she is connected to another tragedy, and that's where the German soldier tragic being occupied, and then she did fall in love with a German soldier, which was taboo as well. So now she's experiencing a new taboo. So okay, well, healthy discussion, guys. Very, very deep film. So yeah.
Aaron, I did want to just mention too, sure, you know, about the filmmaking, kind of the camera work a little bit, because I was struck by where his camera is placed. You know, there's certain scenes where you see them from above, from, you know, behind him looking at her. And I thought of some scenes where they're looking, the camera's actually looking up at them. But the camera move that really stuck out to me the most was the, I won't call them swish pans, but they were, like, you know, like a Scorsese or a Wes Anderson, more of a flash pan. I'm mm-hmm. sorry, not a, like a fast pan, mm-hmm. Where you would see it would go to the left or right. And you see that, if I remember right, it's a camera move where we, the very first time that we see their faces, we've seen their bodies, early in the film, and then we get the Hiroshima pieces, but then it's kind of a fast pan to their faces finally as we start to see them and get to know them. So I really like that technique.
Yeah, and Rene really likes to move the camera. And one of my favorite sequences, which we haven't touched on, is that montage near the end when she's walking through Hiroshima and she's seeing the city. And I don't know much about Hiroshima. It seemed like almost like a gambling city. But and it's intercut or crosscut with images of Nevers and her past. Mm-hmm. And I did notice that there was one building or I guess light fixture in Hiroshima that actually kind of looked like the Eiffel Tower, which of course would not be Nevers, but anyway. All right, well, let's get into ratings, and I hope you guys don't mind if I start. I've been a Criterion collector. Well, we talked about that last week, about the length of time. And the reason I collect films is because I want to have a moving artistic experience, and I'm always waiting for that. And that's why I wait to watch movies. You know, I've known about this movie for 20 years, but I haven't watched it until just this past week. And I don't want to overrate movies. I think we all tend to when we see something amazing, we tend to be a little hyperbolic. But when this film ended, it was one of the most moving cinematic experiences I think I've had. I think of some of my Renoir experiences, some like Persona, and I'm not a big list making kind of guy, but if I were to do a top 20, I don't know, maybe even a top 5, I think this film might have a place. It's profoundly moving for me, and I'd say it's one of the best movies I've seen in years, actually. So 10 is my rating. I loved it. Sorry, that might be a lot to live up to, but did you guys come anywhere near that?
Martin?
This is one of my favorite films. I've been struggling with it for years. It's sort of always on my mind, and I feel like anytime I try to get a hold of it or think I have a hold on it, it sort of slips away and gets a new shape that I struggle with again. But I was going to give it a 9.5 just for the sake of not sounding hyperbolic, but I think you're right. I think this is a 10. I think this is one of the most amazing films ever made.
And yeah. I should qualify. I don't give a lot of 10s out. And I don't know about you, Martin, but I just think that 10
is giving them out left and right. 10s all over the place. No.
Today.
Yeah, I'd written down 9, but it certainly is a 9.5 for me. I mean, it could be close to a 10. I would say, you know, what kind of knocks it down for me is I was thinking of the great commentary from Peter Cowley and how he didn't love the film at first, but he was inspired to revisit it. And I had a similar experience where I think this film is, the rewatchability of this film is extremely high. If you can, you know, of course, get through the first parts with the actual footage of Hiroshima. But I was watching this later at night and having trouble staying awake at times. As I said, it's more of a Sunday afternoon film, and it really requires your attention. And I would recommend it for that. But it's such a rich film that you can think about, deconstruct. And I think as we get into the supplements, we'll talk about how that really informs the film itself. So I'm with Martin for sure with a 9.5, not quite a 10.
Okay, so are you a 10 or a 9.5, Martin? Or does it really matter?
I'd bump it up to 10. I love this film.
All right, so two against nice. One. So. All right, so we love this film. So, and it is nice of Criterion to finally give it to us. It had been a while, but... What, and of course the supplements of the DVD, I think there were a couple new ones. There was the piece about the restoration, that's important. There was the new visual essay, right?
Well, and I know I had a trouble kind of figuring out which was new. I do know that they did remove a couple of items. It's missing the isolated effects and music track that was on the DVD. And there's also there was a video feature going over a sample of annotations written by Duras, the Marguerite Duras, the screenwriter.
Right. And Martin, you have the DVD and the Blu-ray, as you mentioned. So did you see a lot of differences?
Holding them side by side. not a whole lot. I think the big missing feature is that music and effects track, which I actually really like. That's something I'm sort of fascinated by whenever films have that as an option. And I think maybe the there's a one less article in the booklet. I think maybe the booklet's thinner in the Blu-ray version.
Well, one that was added was that Francois Thomas video essay. He's a film scholar and wrote a book about René, and he did touch on some of the score. And of course, there was also the piece, the supplement about the music. The music is just brilliant. It was both Georgia
Delarue.
Thank you. Hello, Joyce. well, actually, it was mostly Giovanni Fusco. Who did the primary, and then Delarue did some supplemental scores. I think he did the waltz in the cafe. The score is tremendous, I think. And of course, as you've heard it, bookending this episode. So what do you think of the supplements? Do you have a favorite, Martin?
The appreciation for the music I thought was a really good addition. I like that special feature. The commentary is okay. I like Peter Cowie once in a while. The interview with Alain René, I think, might be the best, the one from 1961. I think it was the same program that they also did the interviews for Robert Bresson for, like, that was on the Man Escaped disc. I think it's the same room, actually. But I thought that was good. He sort of didn't say much, but it still kind of gives you some insight into the film.
You know, he's almost like the anti-auteur, and I think he actually said something similar in the feature, if I remember, but he's very humble, and I'd almost say he's kind of insecure in a way. He's no Godard or Truffaut.
Right.
By any stretch.
He's definitely a director. I mean, he doesn't write his films, not that necessarily, you know, informs an auteur, but yeah, he calls himself a director of movies, so he's it's nice to have a little humbleness.
But they ask him why he doesn't put a film by Alain René. It's just directed by Wright.
That's true.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. He's not an egoist. You have to. He does let the work speak for itself. And I think, of course, as I just said, I think this one speaks volumes.
And, yeah. As far as the music goes, too. I mean, I like the music supplement. I'm going to invoke Star Wars a little bit because I felt like some of the music. From Fusco, there are kind of themes that are broken up, and I know Cowie talks about this during the commentary, and I think of how themes are used specifically by John Williams in the Star Wars movies, you know, like Yoda has a theme and Princess Leia.
Sure,
so
I
wonder how much John Williams pulled from that. And I even thought of some of the music kind of sounding similar to some of the music during the scenes with the Jawas, so... I know you guys didn't think Star Wars was going to be invoked on this show, right?
Are you saying that they ripped off some things in Star Wars? Is that what you're saying,
maybe.
Mark?
Maybe. Well, hopefully just informed by it. But I enjoyed the commentary quite a bit. I like how Peter Cowie brings in some of the filmmaking. He brings in some of the history talking about the effects of the H-bomb. So I like that quite a bit. I think this, I would have liked to have seen even another commentary from someone else because this film is so rich.
Yeah, yeah. Martin, was that Cowie commentary on the DVD that you have?
It's been on there for a while. I think you're right, though. I think it could have used another commentary. I think I need more points of view on this film.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, it's only been 50 years. What's, you know, what's another 12? So
you're gonna have to sync up this podcast with the DVD.
Yeah, no, I think I enjoy the commentary as well. It's Peter Cowie is I admire him. He's pretty much a fixture with Criterion. Does a lot of essays, and I thought he made some good points. But also, he didn't distract from the movie too. I felt like when I was watching the commentary, I was rewatching the movie, and in fact, I meant to, and I even mentioned on Twitter that I was going to try to watch it in French, and I didn't get around to it.
Well, I, I turned on, I was looking for Pygmy, but they didn't have Pygmy subtitles, unfortunately.
Anyway, they didn't have Pig Latin either. So,
no.
I guess we get to the canon. We've done this a few times, and lately we've been putting films in the canon. Is there any doubt here, you guys? Is this in the canon?
It's a slam dunk.
Yeah. I think this one broke the backboard.
Yes, it did.
This
time
is
to get a new one.
Quite a film. And I'd say I'm glad we got to this in our early period, our eighth episode of the podcast. It's a pretty monumental flagship film that I think we'll come back to very often. So are you with us, Martin? Canon film?
Oh, 100%. I think this definitely is a must watch.
All right, guys. Well, it's been interesting, fascinating, actually, in-depth discussion for me, hopefully for the audience as well. And thank you guys for joining us for this. And we're going to have a brief segment coming up on Romance Across Borders. Welcome back. We have just blown our minds with talking about this dense movie, so we're going to try to lighten it up a little bit and just get into a subtopic, briefly, Romance Across Borders. And I'm going to start this time because my choice, well, let me set up the topic first. Of course, Hiroshima Mon Amour is very much a love story about two different nationalities, as we've just gone over quite a bit of detail. So we thought we'd think of some other movies that talk about intercultural, national relations, again, borders. And we actually thought of a number of examples, but in order to keep it short, we just decided to pick one apiece that we'll talk about in a little bit of detail. And then we'll talk about some others. We'll just mention some names of some others that we think of. There's plenty. And again, if you want to tweet some at us, we'd love to hear back from you. But mine is actually a little personal. As I mentioned in the last show, my wife won Jeopardy last year, and so you'll hear what my choice is by this clip, which I'm going to play right now.
Andrea West is our champion. I want to hear about your romance. We've had a lot of clues about romantic stuff in the last 2 days on our show. I want to hear about your romantic honeymoon.
My husband, Aaron, and I are big film buffs, and we love the movie Before Sunset, which we saw early when we were dating. And on our honeymoon, we went to Paris, and we retraced the steps of Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy in that movie.
It was good, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. You're in command of the board right now.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I love Before Sunset. It's actually sentimental value twice because we visited the locations shot by shot. I think it was 2006. Yeah, 2006. Spoiler alert, it is not a half hour and a half real time. You can't get from location. It took us about 6 hours, and we did not get to the final location, which was probably somebody's apartment in Paris.
Well, you didn't break in? I love that final shot. Jeez, you could have reenacted that one.
Well, there was one. There were, of course, 2006. You know, we didn't have iPhones. Actually, I had an iPod, and I put the movie, which was like a little tiny screen, and we were walking through Paris with this, me playing this little tiny, you know, like 2x2 inch screen. But we found some of the locations you just cannot get to in sequence, and then there's one near the end. We realized that if we actually visited that one, we would probably finish up at midnight. So,
yeah.
But anyway, we love Before Sunset. We love the Before trilogy. Actually, we didn't like Before Midnight as much, but the first two. Sorry, Martin. I heard that groan. The first two are very close to our heart, and as you heard, we saw it Before Sunset together when we were dating. Of course, we are the same nationality, but we still could identify with the romance. I think Before Sunset, Celine and Jesse.
Yes.
I think they do a great job of, kind of like Hiroshima Mon Amour, we don't see the naughty bits, or even Renee-like naughty bits, but we more see the dialogue, a lot of dialogue in those movies, a lot of walking around, but I think those are both special movies. They're special for us for that reason, but also just very well crafted. And actually found out how well crafted they were after we visited those locations, starting at Shakespeare's bookstore. So yeah, that's my choice, is Before Sunset. So what about you, Martin?
My pick is a film called Story of a Three-Day Pass by Melvin Van Peebles, who I just found out last night used to have a film in the Criterion Collection during the Laserdisc days.
And what was that, Sweetback?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's a story about a Black American soldier who has 3 days of leave in France, and it's a romance between him and a white French woman, and it's more focused on race and racism, in contrast to something like Hiroshima Mon Amour, where that never really comes mm-hmm. up as a theme. And it's really energetic, it's really romantic, and it's got also a very sort of enigmatic, slightly pessimistic ending, but I think it's also one of my favorite films. The lead actress, Nicole Berger, she worked with Truffaut and the Romare and Godard, but this was her last film. She died in a car crash almost immediately after the film. And if you watch it, that also really informs her sort of quiet, fatalist kind of performance. I think anyone who likes Hiroshima Mon Amour would probably appreciate this film. So,
Yeah, I'd never heard of it. I'll have to add it to the queue.
Yeah, I think Sweetback is a great example of black exploitation, which, you know, kind of borrowed from the French New Wave.
Film, he made it while he was living in France. He couldn't get a film made in America. And it definitely is, one foot firmly rooted in the French New Wave. But it's also very notably from an American perspective, which makes it kind of an oddity. Mm. But it's great.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at the actress. And, yeah, she was in Shoot the Piano Player. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I'm trying to find the Romare.
One of the short films that Romare made.
Okay.
And I think it came out the same year as Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and film sort of regarded as a classic, but this for me completely blows it out of the water. I feel like the characters are sort of much more fleshed out, and I think it's more interested in telling sort of an essential human story than it is about trying to politicize a particular point. The lead, he's not a professional actor, but it works in that French New Wave kind of a way.
Well, you know, I'm not actually not a fan of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which is probably not a very popular opinion, but I think maybe the reasons I didn't like that might be a reason I would like this. So I will definitely check it out, Martin. Thanks for the recommendation. Have you seen it, Mark?
I don't think... I haven't seen Story of a Three-Day Pass. I liked Guess Who's Coming to Dinner quite a bit, especially towards the end, but I don't think you're alone, Aaron. I think there's been a bit of backlash. I don't know if it's recently or, you know, just folks not being a big fan. I know Twilight Time is releasing it mm-hmm. soon or just came out, so...
Yeah, I think there's sort of a backlash against the kind of white guilt, white racial theme. Of course, you could say the back crash from Crash.
There you go. Yep.
I think nice we did. We just there. Coin a phrase there.
Back crash.
Yep. Back crash.
It's going to go viral. Just create a hashtag.
Story of a 3-day crash. All right, Mark. What do you got?
Well, I have a little obscure film to talk about. It's actually referenced in the film itself, and the last nightclub, you'll see the sign says Casablanca. So, no, it's not an obscure film starring Humphrey Bogart, of course, also starring Ingrid Bergman, Paul Henride, I believe it is, and Claude Rains, of course, probably the best performance in the film. And so this one, it's set in Casablanca in Morocco during the early days of World War II. So an American expatriate meets a former lover with unforeseen complications. So, this one, of course, informs, I think, Hiroshima Mon Amour quite a bit. It's even referenced in a book on René by James Morocco. He ends his chapter on Hiroshima Mon Amour by claiming that the film contains a reference to the classic film, which, of course, it does, is another impossible love story between two people. Struggling with the imagery of a distant war. So, and I think, you know, with the, we talked about romance across borders. I mean, this one crosses a number of borders because you have Ilsa Lund, who's with Victor Laszlo. Ilsa's from Oslo, I believe, Norway. Victor is a Czech, he's resistance fighter, I guess you'd call him, against the Nazis. And then you have Bogart's character, Rick Blaine, who's an American who's running the bar. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, different countries, but you also have them trying to bring Victor Laszlo across the border to America, of course, through Morocco. So
it's not only romance across borders, but also bromance across borders.
Right. Right. Do you think they had bromance back in 1942?
I don't think so.
Hey, Greg, you got to help me.
So I just want to mention too, I mean, this movie reminds a little bit of, there's from the Hiroshima commentary. There's a little bit of, you know, does she in Hiroshima Matamor, does she make her plane or not? And I know you, I kind of thought of, it reminds a bit of, Before Sunset,
yeah.
You know, with, Hiroshima, Before Sunset, also, you know, with, the ending to this film. So a lot of symmetry there.
There are planes referenced in all three. And I didn't go too in depth with Before Sunset, but yeah, and I'm not going to go in depth in how it relates to a plane. But actually I didn't pick up on the reference to Casablanca while watching Hiroshima, but I guess, you know, when you think about the, we'll always have Paris, Hiroshima is, right, we'll never have Paris. And
right,
there's the play on the word never, never.
And I can absolutely see how the flashbacks in Casablanca might have informed René. I think it's also a film about the past kind of existing through the present.
For sure, yeah. I definitely see that. And well, maybe not so much Linklater, but... so anyway, I think those are all great choices. I want to check out that Peebles. Hopefully it's available somewhere. But, and you mentioned, of course, with Casablanca, Bergman, the trilogy she did with Rossellini, those are all good examples of romance across borders, or like Stromboli, maybe not so romance across border. And then actually you could say Journey to Italy is not so romantic across the border, but can you guys, without going into detail, think of many other titles?
Well, I remember you'd mentioned, Aaron, I was going to talk about this one, of course, Ex Machina, which is more, instead of across borders, more across species.
Yeah.
So I thought that would have been an interesting pick and example. So that's a film from this year, folks haven't seen. Definitely one of the better movies this year, starring the Inside Llewyn Davis star.
Oscar
Isaacs, thank you.
Isaac Davis.
So, yeah, really, really great film from this year. Martin?
A couple I thought of, The New World, which I mentioned last time I was on the show.
You did, yeah.
That's a film that I think is definitely meets the description. Terrence Malick actually is newer film, To the Wonder, is also similar. Sort of this
good pick.
European-American love triangle. Green Card's one I thought of, with Andy McDowell and Gerard Depardieu, by Peter Weir, from Made Picnic at Hanging Rock. Shakespeare Walla from the Merchant Ivory titles is also kind of a romance across borders, so good stuff.
Yeah, it's a recurring theme. You see it in a lot of movies. And of course, we went in very, very in-depth on Hiroshima, on why that was fascinating with the tragedy and the nationalities. But why do you think cross-culture movies work? What do you think, Martin?
Well, I think dramatically it probably lends itself really well to a film. I was sort of thinking of Eisensteinian montage theory, like opposition, bang, bang, collision.
Sure.
How you get this kind of kinetic thrill from seeing people who are different in some way coming together. And I think maybe that, you know, it might tell us something about empathizing and relating with human beings in a way that's deeper than culture or skin color or whatever.
It kind of gives a built-in arc, I guess.
I'm never sure how personal to get on podcasts, but I've lived in different places, different cultures, so for me every romance I've had has sort of been a cross-culture tryst. So I'm sure I might relate to these strongly because of that. Right now I'm in a relationship with a woman who has a pretty different background than me, so maybe I'm biased, but I like this type of film.
What about your bromances, Martin?
That's getting really personal.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I didn't mean to, go
this
there.
This is a podcast across borders. So.
It technically is, actually. Modern technology. So,
it's funny.
What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of topic is inherently interesting for dramatic storytelling. I mean, it's got drama built right into it when you're talking about cross-culture trysts. I mean, you've got, of course, we talked about the language differences, culture differences, race differences, those barriers, and just the, in some cases, as we've been talking about, forbidden love based on the time frame standards of that time. You know, those cases can kind of inform the story. So I think immediately you already have an interesting topic to write about and then make a film about.
Yeah, I agree, and I didn't go too in depth on the Before series, but that kind of they don't really throw many nods to it, but they both experience cultures at the same time. They start with Vienna, then they are in Paris, and then later in Greece. And of course, Paris, the middle one, is her hometown. So yeah, I think that does. You're right. That does build. And also it builds suspense because, you know, can these cultures be bridged?
Right.
And that's like we mentioned with the race films as well. You could actually make the same connection with race films as you can with cross-culture films. Like Martin said, a lot of times they're sort of linked together. So, okay, well, this was a brief discussion, but I think an interesting, supplement to Hiroshima, which was Mammoth.
Right.
Thanks, Martin, for coming back. We'll have to have you on again.
Eventually.
Yeah, we will have. We'll definitely have you back, but I don't know which movie. We'll have to figure that out.
Oh, thank you.
So, Martin, do you want to tell us where to find you online?
Folks can find me on Twitter at MovieKessler.
Mark, where can people find you?
So folks can find me on Twitter at Mark Herney, at MarkHurne, and of course on Letterboxd at MHURNE.
And I am Aaron, and you can find me on Twitter at AWest505. My letterbox is DSNT, I think. I'll put a link in the show notes. Think of doesn't, the word, the contraction without the vowels. It's a weird name. And then, of course, Criterion Blues, where you can find the podcast. You can also find the podcast, or you can email us at feedback@criterionclosesup.com. And next week, we're going to get into Wes Anderson and why people love him and why people hate him. So that will be fun, and we'll have a special guest, David Blakesley.
Yeah, cool. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think so. Well, thanks again, Martin. Thanks, Mark. This has been fun.